Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. The last few podcasts have run quite long, but this one, I can't imagine it going very long at all. Because I don't have much to say about this book, although saying that I could end up doing an hour and a half. No, probably not. So the book that I'm going to be reviewing today is the second book, or the sequel to The Sparrow by Mary Doria Russell. So it's on Goodreads, it's called Sparrow Number 2, titled Children of God. Now, I got into this book because The Sparrow had been one of those books which was like one of the most recommended books by Science Fiction Book Review Podcast listeners to me. Loads of people have mentioned it in emails. Lots of people have talked about this and talked about that. It's Catholics, it's Jesuits in space and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, okay. Finally got round to reading it. Absolutely loved it. Some minor issues, but still a five-star book just because, you know, the characters are great. It's just like everything about it was really, really good. I really enjoyed it. And then someone said, hey, are you going to read the sequel? And I was like, wait, there's a sequel? How can there be a sequel? Because it's no spoilers to say in The Sparrow, it even begins with, okay, this guy comes back from a Jesuit mission to Rakat, which is a planet around Alpha Centauri, comes back from Rakat and is the only survivor. And he's the only survivor. And at the end of that story, again, no spoilers, but he kind of had, there was a resolution to his story. And I'm like, well, that's it. Okay, that must be it. So if he's the only survivor of the mission, where do we go? Where do we go from here? And of course, what we do is in book two, Children of God, we go back to Rakat. We go back there. Both physically and story-wise. So the setup for this is, again, it's like, well, I guess the setup for this is The Sparrow. You should listen to that review. But if you haven't, the idea being that there's been a signal from Rakat, the planet, although we just know it as a planet around Alpha Centauri. We get a signal, and then some Jesuits go, hey, it's a Jesuit priest and some of his friends who are the first ones to pick up the signal, and the Jesuit order of the Catholic Church, or whatever, the Society of Jesus, decides, hey, we can actually get there. We reckon we can actually get there if we get some asteroids and attach the things to it, and we've got the money, we'll sell lots of artwork and sell some property, because the church has a lot of money, and they put together a secret mission and fly off to Rakat. And then it recounts, you know, the book recounts all the stuff that goes on, how did they get there, what the aliens were like when they got there, and it's like a non-linear story, also telling the story of what happened to Emilio Sandoz when he got back and the process that he gets through, you know, to get over the psychological trauma of what he's gone through there, being the only survivor and the nasty things that have happened to him. So you go, okay, so that's the story. He gets through that trauma, or we get to an end point in that trauma. This book starts off, and again, I was thinking, well, how is this going to work? Emilio Sandoz, who is our main character in the first book, he's back on Earth, and we get a little bit of, he meets a family, and he meets a girl who happens to be, the daughter of the ex-wife of the local mafia guy who has ties to the Jesuit main guy one of the main guys, Father Vincent Giuliani, is part of the mafia, the Camorra, the mafia family of Venice, and he's living near Venice, and he's kind of like some connections there, and he gets kind of into the world of the Camorra a bit, and you're like, wait a second, isn't it a bit dangerous to get together and have a love affair with the ex-wife of the son of the main mafia boss? And you're like, well, okay, that might not work out. But anyway, that's what's happening. And he's kind of getting on with his life, and he discovers that some savings that he put away years and years ago, or some money that some people left him, it turns out relativity, when you go up off to another planet and come back and 40 years has passed on Earth and only 2 years has passed in your timeline, interest accrues and investments do well for him, and he gets back and suddenly he's like set, and you're like, oh, okay, this story is kind of set, right? He's found love. He's thinking he might get married and stuff like that. So where does the story go? Well, actually, he is tapped by the Jesuits again to say, hey, look, what we'd like you to do, you're the best guy who knows about Rakat. You know the different languages that the aliens speak there. So could you train up a new group of guys and we're going to get together a new mission and go back to Rakat? And anyway, I don't want to give too many spoilers. He ends up on that mission going back to Rakat. Meanwhile, you think, okay, well, that's interesting. So he's going there. Meanwhile, there's this thing where you go, okay, at the end of the last novel, all of the characters except Emilio died. So who is left on Rakat to kind of pick up the story there? And you're like, okay, Supari, who was one of the main aliens, one of the main, what do you call the Janata aliens, one of the species, the kind of ruling class, the ruling species, he's still around, and he's the one who kind of set things in motion for the end of the story and what Emilio Sandoz goes through. And then he realizes he's made a mistake, and one of his rewards for doing what he did at the last book is like, oh, you're going to get a wife, and even though you're the third son, you're allowed to breed now. And he's like, oh, okay, I'm getting... So there's some family stuff going on there with Supari, which I thought was quite interesting because I did like Supari. And so at the start of the book, we get a bit of Supari action. I was like, okay, this is good. And we get a bit of Fithin Kfithery, who was one of the main leaders on Rakat now among the Janata. And you're like, okay, so I like this character as well. He was interesting in the first book. He was the one who sent out the radio messages, which first kind of called people from Earth to Rakat. And so it's like, okay, he's quite important. He's one of the main characters in the overall story. And so we get a bit of that. And then we get this weird situation where, oh, this character who you thought died at the end of the last book when we were told everybody died except Emilio Sandoz. It turns out one of them wasn't killed. She was just a bit injured. She got a cut across her face and then she was recovered and she survived. So Sophia from the first book, who was like probably like the second main human character in that first book, you're just like, oh, Sophia Mendes. She survived and she's pregnant. So, okay, so she's there as well. And it was a bit, it felt a little bit like retconning. Sure, it isn't said explicitly that this, we didn't, like, she didn't die on screen. We didn't see the claws of the Janata, like, slicing her throat open like we did some other characters. Nobody kind of recovered her corpse at the end of that story. And that's the direction they went. Even though there was another mission, the UN mission to Rakat, I thought it might pick up there. You know, we never found out what happened to those people who went on the other mission, except as it states right at the start of the first book, it says this mission found Emilio Sandoz, sent him home. But what happened to them? We never found out. And this, again, we kind of don't find out, but it was like this little retconning kind of thing. It was just like, oh, everybody likes this character and she was the main character. Let's just bring her back. And then there can be this thing where she's going to meet Emilio Sandoz, or is she going to come home to Earth and meet Emilio Sandoz? Or is Emilio Sandoz going to go to back to Rakat and she's going to go back to Earth, and then they cross each other in interstellar space and miss each other? And there's these questions which are interesting, and it's nice that she's back and it's fun to spend that time with the character, but it kind of lessens a little bit of what happened in the first book. Like, if I'd have read the first book knowing actually there is some hope in the future that Emilio Sandoz can meet up with Sophia and sort of patch things up with her or continue, you know, all that kind of stuff, it kind of lessens it. But I didn't have that when reading the first book, so it doesn't diminish the first book. It doesn't diminish the Sparrow at all. But it just kind of sets off Children of God in a way which I'm just like, oh, really? Is this where we're going for? So that's kind of the setup for it, and then it plays out. What's happening back on Rakat? I'll get into a bit more in a second. This sequel is kind of interesting. It's like it's like a study. Like, if you were going to study, what do you do with a sequel, or how can a sequel be different from the first book? I think this book would be, it's just an interesting study because, like, okay, what made the story work in the first book, considering that this is kind of a not a retelling, but like a replaying of it? Like, we get a team together, we get a crew together, we go to Rakat, we interact with the locals and see what happens there. and with lots of Catholic stuff and Jewish stuff and religious stuff and questions of faith and questions of good and evil, all that kind of stuff thrown in there. Like, it's kind of like the similar thing. However, I realize what happened in the first book is that it started off, as I said, in media res, and you get these two different storylines playing in with each other. Like, what happened on the main mission, and then Emilio, what is going on with him when he gets back. And because we know, in broad strokes, what happened in that first mission, that everybody died and Emilio was the only one to come back, it's like, okay, we've got a goal in mind for the main part of the storyline, and how do we get there? How are we getting there? Like, why did everyone die? What happened to this mission? What happened to the other mission that found them? You know, all that kind of stuff. And then in the other storyline, which is, you know, Emilio Sanders, you know, coming to terms with what happened to him and being counseled by, you know, other Jesuit priests and stuff, that, like, you kind of know that there's going to be some kind of resolution to that story, but that's the very emotional heart of the story. Emilio Sanders getting over what happened in The Sparrow, during this retelling of The Sparrow story, gives it that emotional heart. The second book, Children of God, doesn't have either that, oh, something big has happened at the end of this and we're working towards it kind of feeling, because it just starts and Emilio Sanders is kind of like, oh, he meets a girl and he meets a wife and he meets, you know, he gets together. And then on the other side, it's like, oh, stuff is happening, you know, because the humans arrived on Rakat, the Janata and the Runa, there's some more tension between the two of them, and there's some kind of genocide-y kind of stuff going on to wipe out all of the Runa who've ever had contact with humans. And there's big stuff happening there. But there's never like an end point. There's never an end goal like stated at the start of what we're working towards. And also, because we don't have that kind of moments where we're like, okay, this is now like we're going to disconnect from that main story and go across here, and we're just going to get like this emotional heart of the story. That's not there either. Even though there is a lot of like attempted emotional heart in this, it always feels a bit disconnected. You know, like what Emilio goes through in this book is interesting. What Sophia goes through and her journey and her son's journey, and the other like species on Rakat and what they're going through, because there's not the end point, it's a little bit tricky to kind of get like pulled through the story. Like even in The Sparrow, when it got a bit slow at times, I'm like, yes, but I'm still being pulled towards the end of the story. And this book, the first half of this book, is quite slow. It's quite slow paced, and things are taking a long time. And also, because there's the time differences, like stuff that's happening back on Earth is happening like 40 years before the stuff that we're reading is happening back on Rakat. And then the stuff that happens on Rakat, like it has to be kind of accelerated when they're on the spaceship going there, because time dilation and like the different parts of the story feel more compressed and less compressed. And and they're kind of told in chronological order, but not like in the time zones. And it's weird how they go, oh, this is this time Earth relative on Rakat, this is the time back on Earth. Whereas actually I'd preferred it if it was just like telling both stories, so the story of Emilio Sanders is just told like every other chapter, and the story of what's happened on Rakat is just being told every other chapter, but they don't need to link up in the way that they do. They don't need to be, you know, I just think there could have been a better way of telling it, so the pacing between the two stories would have been there. Because for the first half of the story, most of the stuff is just happening on Earth and a little bit on Rakat. And then at the end, it's about all the humans on Rakat. But there's this big middle section where all of this massive epic stuff is going down on Rakat between the Janata and the Runa. And it's kind of skipped over in favour of what's happening with the humans either on the way there or hanging out. And I think that's a weakness until it gets to about one half to two thirds of the way through, when suddenly there's this new storytelling style comes on, and it's sort of like, oh, and then when this character, Danny Ironhorse? I can't remember the, yeah, Danny Ironhorse, and he was talking years later, 20 years later, to Sophia, and I was like, oh, okay, so Danny Ironhorse and Sophia both make it past the events at the end of this book, and now they're kind of talking about in the future, looking back. And suddenly, as soon as that happened, like the book came alive to me, and I was like, oh, right, okay, now I have something that we're aiming for. But it only came after the halfway point of the book. So this book really feels like a book of two halves. The first half, where it just felt like stuff happening and there was no driving force to the story. And then the second half, when we were like, oh, okay, shit has gone down on Rakat and these humans made it through to the aftermath and now we're going to find out what's happening in the aftermath. Or this alien, this Janata and this human are talking after the fact about what happened. Yeah, it suddenly accelerated through the second half. Although I don't think the second half is a stronger story. It's just sort of like the storytelling device clicks into place and suddenly it becomes kind of more interesting when I've kind of got a destination to push through the story to get towards, like the sparrow, like the first book had right from the very first page. So let me have a look at my notes because I made a few notes here. So, Amelia... Oh, I've gone through. Oh yeah, so there's the good ship that when they go back to Rakat, there's the good ship, the Giordano Bruno, and I quite like the crew that is put together to go there, because in the first book it was like very much, okay, this is a mission from God. We're on a mission from God. We're getting the band together, and they get the band together and they go off and there's a mission, and it's very kind of spiritual, and also because they're Jesuits, it's very scientific. Here what happens is that the mafia connections kind of pay for this thing. So the Jesuits are like, oh, can we come along on this mafia business trip? And other people who have worked, you know, who have fought in, you know, separatist movements. There's someone from Northern Ireland and there's someone from the Basque region and there's some other people. They're like, yeah, we need to go to Rakat and help the Runa fight against the Janata. We're going to sort of lead them. We're going to lead them against their oppressors. And there's, you know, the kind of the aims of the different people on the ship are, you know, so it's sort of like quite interesting that you've got these different Jesuits and mafia people kind of coexisting on the ship. And I really enjoyed them. I mean, I don't think any of the characters really stood out as like amazing characters, but the interaction between the characters I did find quite fascinating, of the different power balances on the ship and as they're doing it, and Emilio Sandoz is, you know, is given some jobs to do, and then Carlos, who's like the main mafia guy, is given other things to do, but, you know, his personality is strange. So I really enjoyed that section, even though I think it probably takes up a little bit too much time of the book, considering I think the main story... the main story could have been more what's happening on Rakat, and especially what happens there at the end of the book. So that was fun to read as well. A thing that I found a bit strange though is that we're told that other spaceships have tried to get across to Rakat, but only two have ever made it, and now this third one is going across, and it just seems a little bit too easy, or a little bit too what am I trying to say? It's a bit, it seems a bit too set. It seems a bit too written that it's just like, oh, other ships have made it, but they didn't make it there. Or other ships tried to get there, but they didn't make it. So they don't impact on the story. So it's like the only ships that have any impact on the story just happen to be the only ones that got there, got to Rakat. All the others blew up in on the way there, trying to go too fast, or yeah, they go too fast and they hit a rock or hit a bit of dust or whatever it is. And we do get that kind of played out. On the Giordano Bruno, we kind of get to see what it's like to go through interstellar space a bit, which is, so it actually shows it is dangerous to do, to get there, which is quite fun. I think scientifically implausible, but you know, it doesn't always have to be that way in science fiction books. Anyway, just it's a little bit convenient. That's all I'm saying. That only when Emilio Sandoz is involved in a mission that it seems to make it. I think it's actually said in the book as well. It's like, oh, it's weird that all the other ships crash, but when any time Emilio is on a ship, he makes it. That means he's blessed by God. I'm like, oh, he's either blessed by God or he's blessed by Mary Doria Russell, who wrote the book. My next note is, oh right, yeah. So here's the thing that I like about like the story of this book. There is awesome stuff happening on Rakat between the Janata and the Runa, and of course, I don't want to give too much away, but like there's these big, you know, these battles and like massive changes. Cliven Clithery, I can't even remember how to pronounce his name, but he's someone who is very important in the first book. He kind of takes over and puts in place all these changes, you know, like he's kind of very revolutionary. He takes over and he's like one of these people who's like, ah, I'll be the philosopher king. I'll make everyone better. everything better for everyone, and it's all going to be great, isn't it? Yes, it's going to be great. It doesn't always turn out to be great. But I was just thinking, like, why don't we spend more time with this? It's kind of told in passing, like, after the fact. It's like, oh, remember that time when this happened? Remember the time that happened? And I was like, this could have been a novel just in its own right. That's like almost what I thought the Children of God would be. Like, you know, forget the humans. Now let's, like, concentrate on the aliens. Well, I want to call them aliens, but the people, the species from Rakat. And then Supari, we get a bit more of him. And then the Runa, we get more of their story. But really, like I said before, it kind of just goes, right, let's concentrate on the humans. Oh, this other stuff is happening. But these epic battles and these, you know, clashes, and you're like, oh, this is a real great allegory of standing up. Like, what would have happened? Like, I know it's weird to say things like this, but it's often told from the point of view of Sophia, and she's Jewish, so she's like, oh, I will be the person who leads these out of the wilderness, or lead them out of Egypt, and lead them through the wilderness, and there's going to be 40 years in the wilderness, and then we're going to get to the promised land, and it's going to be flowing with milk and honey. And you get a bit of that, and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, I kind of see that. Oh, and maybe it's like, you know, some Holocaust things there as well, some genocide stuff going on there. What would happen if they rose up, and then there's a persecuted minority, and it kind of flips both ways, you know, like, which side is the more persecuted one, and why would Sophia, who is a Jew, kind of be on one side or the other, be for one side and not the other. So there's interesting questions there. But a lot of the big things are just kind of told in, like told after the fact. Oh, this happened and that happened. And then there's these, like, big characters, and it's like, oh, what happened to them? And it's like, oh, just in passing, it was mentioned, like, there was this big battle, and then, oh, this character died and that character died, and they were really important. I was like, oh, and that's it. And then they're just never mentioned anymore, or, you know, they're only mentioned in passing, or only their relatives kind of continue on their story. And I just think, like, while that storytelling is very different, and it doesn't feel like The Sparrow, and it doesn't even feel like the rest of Children of God, there's so much interesting stuff going on there, which, like, the first book, The Sparrow, was all about, we're in this alien civilization. And while that is very much a backdrop of what happens for the human characters and their journey and their faith journey, it was, like, really interesting to discover, okay, what are the Runa? What are the Janata? How do the cities work? How do the countries work? You know, what do they eat here and what do they eat there? And why are these people doing there? And why are they singing? Why do these people not like it? All of these questions, which are kind of like, the scientists get to a cat and start investigating them. Here, we just get, oh, here's some answers, but there wasn't any of that, like, studying of the different cultures, which is strange considering, like, that's what is happening on Rakat. Like, these cultures which are clashing is the most important thing, whereas where you spend a lot more time is like, oh, here's Sophia and her son, who is, slightly autistic or majorly autistic, you know, like, we spend much more time in the heads of the human characters. I'm thinking, but there's this massive epic thing going on over here, which I kind of wanted a bit more of. So what else do I have to say? Not really. I've got to the end of my notes. Oh, yeah, the narration. I listened to this as an audiobook. Different narrator from the first book. This one was narrated by Anna Fields, who does a pretty good job. But it is weird because I just listened to the audiobook, the audiobook of The Sparrow, and the way that the narrator there did the voices was very kind of very specific, and I knew the characters by what their voices were. Anna Fields does a really good job of kind of picking up there. I was never confused when a character started speaking. I was like, oh, who's this again? There's not a lot of, there was some more accent work, which is good, but I don't know. I would have liked it if it would have been the same narrator, but I think that's just about, you know, my own comfort in the book and knowing the characters with their voices. But Anna Fields does a solid job with the audio narration. If you want, you can actually get this book. Here comes an Audible plug. You can go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP and you can download this book for free, except don't, just get The Sparrow because it's better, much better than this book. And you can sign up for a free trial, get a free audiobook, and it's yours forever. If you want to continue on with your trial, you end up paying, like, was it 10 euros or 20 euros a month or whatever, for one or two credits, and you can spend them on any audiobook. And a long book like this is actually a pretty good deal because you get a lot of book for your money. If you want just a shorter book that you can get through more quickly, that's great too. But signing up, I really enjoy listening to audiobooks. And I think if you're a podcast listener and you're a science fiction fan that you're listening to this podcast, I think you'd really appreciate it too. So go and start your free trial at audibletrial.com/SFBIP. And that helps out the podcast here as well. And of hosting fees and book buying things too. So that's pretty much all I have to say about this. I've generally been like, pointing out the differences between the two books. This book is not in any way as good as The Sparrow. But here's the key thing. If you're going into a sequel that you didn't even know existed, and people say, oh yeah, are you going to read the sequel? I read it, I don't think it's worth reading. And other people saying, well, it doesn't really add anything, it's nowhere near as good as this, as the first book. I was kind of going into this having like a very average kind of I was prejudiced against this book in both ways, because some people said, oh, you've really got to read the sequel to get all everything that you need out of the first book. I don't think that's true. And other people said, no, don't bother reading it. So I went in with a very average opinion of the book before I read it. And I've come out of it with a kind of a slightly higher than average view of the sequel. I like spending more time with the characters. I don't think the story is as good. It's kind of more interesting. There is some good stuff in here. But it did feel just like an exercise in sequel writing. It felt like an exercise of like, oh, I've made this really popular book, and it was very, you know, it went down really well, and it was critically acclaimed, and lots of people loved the characters. Let's just have a bit more of it. And I'm like, do we really need a bit more? We don't need a bit more, but people wanted it, and this book was written, and I think it delivers on what those people would have wanted. You know, slight, you know, fan fiction-y kind of like, oh, this character isn't dead after all, kind of. That's that aside, I think it is actually an interesting story with more questions being answered and more questions being raised and then answered. You know, it's not just like, oh, remember this from the first book? Let's have a bit more of that. There are actually some new things going on and new characters. So I would say it is probably, if you've read The Sparrow and enjoyed it and you've heard bad things about this book, it's not that bad. It's probably worth reading. It's like I'd say a solid 3-star novel, which isn't like, it isn't anything like the 5-star novel, but it's like, there's nothing majorly wrong with it, except like the idea that the sequel exists at all. Like, if you're offended at the idea that there's a sequel of The Sparrow, don't read Children of God. But if you're like, oh, sequel, right? Yeah, read it. There's nothing wrong with it. So even like I say, even it's just not as strong. It's just not, there's just not that, you know, driving story that I felt, and like the mystery of the first book. And there's not the emotional core of the first book. You know, that first book, there was certain things that happened and I was just like, oh my God, you know. And in this book, things were happening. I'm like, oh, it's quite interesting. Yeah, all right. Oh, okay. And the first book was like, are they going to, will they, well, no way, it's going to, and this book's just like, you know, it's that kind of a book. 3 stars, I'd say. Nothing wrong with it. Slightly above average, but nothing special at all. So that's it. What have I got next to read? I am reading the Long Trip to a Small Angry Planet. I'm about halfway through that, and the story hasn't started there either yet. I'm reading that as an ebook and as an audiobook. I haven't started the new audiobook, but I am reading, let me just look, because I can't remember what my next audiobook is. My next audiobook is, come on, Audible, instead of The Golem and the Genie, which is another book which has been recommended to me many, many times over the last few years since it came out, by Helena Wecker. Helena Wecker? I don't know. I will, for the next podcast, I will work out how to pronounce that name and then review that book. It's a 19-hour audiobook, which means it might be a while to get to it. I have been so busy recently with traveling and moving house stuff is kind of just finishing up. Finally giving the keys back giving the keys of the old apartment back. Julian is doing all that while I am traveling and working and stuff. But yeah, getting through some stuff. My new album is out. That's another thing that I want to mention. If you like comedy music, if you search for Luke Burridge on iTunes or Apple Music, you can listen to my new live comedy album. All songs written about things, about suggestions that have been shouted out by the audience in shows. I write songs about it, and that whole album is there. You can find that. You can probably listen to it for free on Spotify and Apple Music, or you can just buy it. That would be really cool. Buy it on iTunes. It would be really great. It's called Overly Suggestible. But just search for Luke Burridge on iTunes and things, you'll find it there. What else have I been up to? Juggling a lot? check out my YouTube channel. And also, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge. And also, I've signed up for Instagram, which has got nothing to do with science fiction or books or anything. But if you're interested in seeing one photo a day from my life, about my shows and juggling and traveling and shows that I've seen and just general photo stuff, I think you'll enjoy it. You can find me there. Luke Burridge there too. And I'm luke@juggler.net. If you want to email me, and also sign up for goodreads.com. Oh yes, that's a good thing. I've got that page open on my laptop now. I can actually see, I gave this 3 stars, Children of God. Other people gave it 4.04 stars in general. And what do I have here? Friends reviews. Yeah, a 3.23 average by friend reviews. And friends on Goodreads pretty much just means science fiction book review podcast listeners. So I think I'm in line with other science fiction book review podcast listeners of this being about a 3-star book, between 3 stars and 3.5 stars. And 3.23 average of the 33 friends of mine who have reviewed it is about right too. So let's have a look here. Robert Delicat rates it 3 stars. Ryan, 4 stars. Tom Trzanski, 3 stars. Guillermo rated it 2 stars. Well, it's not that bad. And other people, yeah, 3 and 4 stars seems to be the main thing there. So become my friends on goodreads.com, and I can also see what you're reading and what you think of books, and you can recommend books to me there. And also join in with the Science Fiction Book Review podcast, a listener group on Goodreads. That'll be cool too. I think I'm all caught up. That'll do for now. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.